Welcome again to Heroin, Butt, Sex, and Lord of the Rings. Let's find out some of the secret meanings behind some popular songs here. What do you say, guys? All right, we are joined today by Tyler Wilcox, a writer for Pitchfork, and his column Invisible Hits. Definitely check it out. We will include links to access his articles for Pitchfork. Thank you very much for joining us, Tyler.
Yeah, I'm glad to do it.
Of course, we're joined, as always, by Sean Keane and myself, Richie Molyneux.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Well, Tyler, what new exciting articles are you writing coming up?
Gosh, I don't know. I have a Neil Young thing coming out in a magazine, a British magazine called Uncut, coming out in a month or two, something like that. It's a print magazine. It's very confusing because you write something and then it takes like three, they have deadlines that are, you know, this is for the May issue or something. So it'll be out in a month or something, but it's cool. They're doing a big commemorative thing about Neil Young and Crazy Horse, at 50, their first record came out in, I think April or May of 1969. So they're doing a big thing, contributed to that. And yeah, continuing to do the Invisible Hits column for Pitchfork, which they somehow just let me keep doing.
That's great. Well, I love those. I've read a whole bunch of them.
Cool. Yeah. No, they're fun to do, and hopefully, yeah, I'll just keep on doing them until they say, please stop. Please stop this.
Please, Tyler, stop it. I think maybe we should just launch right into it here with our first song of the week, which is Ring of Fire, 1962, written by June Carter Cash and Merle Kilgore. First recorded, I think, by Anita Carter, correct?
Yeah, I think that's June Carter's sister.
June Carter's sister.
Okay.
And
she's one of the Carter family.
Yeah.
She's in there.
And then the other guy who wrote it is he's like a Carter, Merle Kilgore, who was a Carter cousin, and he also was Hank Williams Jr.'s manager.
Wow.
A legend of country music.
I guess so.
Best man at Johnny Cash's wedding, too.
And the legend, at least, I don't know exactly that this is 100% confirmed, which was that Johnny gave Anita a year to turn it into a hit. That didn't really happen. And then he recorded it himself, Mexican-style mariachi trumpets, perhaps, you know, transformed it into the giant hit it became.
Yeah, that's what I think of when I think of the song is the mariachi horns.
Yeah,
those are iconic.
Mm-hmm. And here are the lyrics in case you can't get to a place where you can read them right now. Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. The taste of love is sweet when hearts like ours meet. I fell for you like a child. Oh, but the fire went wild. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. So
the official story of this, the like official version of the meaning of this is that June Carter says it's about falling in love.
Right.
And Johnny Cash's first wife says that June did not write it.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny wrote it, and he was real high and messed up, and it is about a particular part of a woman's anatomy, is what she said.
Mm.
So two different, somewhat similar interpretations in the official record, but neither of those is Heroin or Lord of the Rings or specifically about sex, so I think we can kind of dismiss those two out of hand.
Yeah, none of those seem that credible to me. And the fact that they're all disputed, it's very hard to get a straight answer out of a lot of writers about what they're actually talking about in their songs, leaving it to serious critics like ourselves to really hash it out and figure it out for all time.
Yeah.
So does anyone want to jump in first on this one?
I I could give you my half baked thoughts on it.
Okay.
You know, when I think of Ring of Fire, I think of the mariachi horns. I think of Johnny Cash's voice, obviously. But I also think of this documentary I saw when I was like, I don't know, I was probably like 7 or 8. It was a PBS documentary. I guess it's maybe the place that has the most active volcanoes in the world.
I've heard about this, and it's hard to imagine that that's not where they got the term
Ring of Fire. Yeah, I mean, I think they've been calling that forever. So, I mean, that's probably predates June Carter and Merle Kilgore doing the song. So I assume that was just floating around. But, you know, I mean, the thing that makes me sort of come back to this, the Ring of Fire, the volcanoes, is, of course, you know, Mount Doom and Lord of the Rings, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mount Doom. That's sure. That's the volcano. Am I mistaken about
No, that's correct. Orodruin, yeah, Mount Doom.
Orodruin, okay. Mount Doom is a volcano. Where I'm right about that. I'm sort of off on my Lord of the Rings knowledge.
Right. Is it correct that you have been recently reading The Hobbit?
I've been reading with my daughter, so she knows the that stuff. Mount Doom Mount Doom is just in the last? Is that where Sauron lives? Is that right?
It's next to the Dark Tower. It is where the Ring of Power was forged.
Okay, good. Well, that just to go along with all that, I mean, it does seem like they must have gotten like Ring of Fire from this place where there are all these volcanoes. That's where June Carter, Merle Kilgore, if we're going with the theory that they wrote the song, that must be where they got the name. The volcanoes, it seems like that would tie back into Mount Doom. That's as far as I've gotten.
Okay. So how
maybe someone else can help me fill this in, you know, if we can get to the bottom of this. I don't know if you guys have right. the same general theory or not.
Well, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to tackle this one early just because, you know, early in our podcast, just because I know that it seems quite obvious, and it's sort of like, oh, a fire and a ring. It's all right there in the name of the song. And you would expect it to be like requested and stuff like that. But it is kind of dicey to pick apart. And I think what makes it difficult for me to sort of nail down in terms of its themes, it is this troublesome background where he's talking about this horrible, seemingly horrible experience of falling into this ring of fire and the flames and everything like that. But on the other hand, he's talking about how sweet the love is, how it when hearts like ours meet. You know, it's sort of, it's like, well, if that's Mount Doom, then where's this love stuff like coming from? You know,
so right.
That's like the difficulty for me. What about you, Sean? Do you see?
Well, I'm gonna have to go with Tyler here. I understand the difficulty, but I think the reason is there's a specific thing that June Carter and I think Merle Kilgore were alluding to with this song, which is that. This song is tangentially about Mount Doom, but really this is about Isildur.
Mm.
Okay.
Yeah. So let me just, I'll back it. So I think the reason that the mariachi horns fit so well is that they're martial. It tells you about, lets you know that like that's the kind of thing you would play when an army is about to attack. So
sure. I would be scared if the army started playing that music.
Yeah. So let me just give you a little backstory on Isildur. He's living in Numenor with his father Elendil. And at this point, the king of Numenor, Alfarazon, has captured Sauron. He's taken him back to Numenor as a prisoner. Sauron's like, great, I'm going to turn these Numenorians into him. And
the seduction of the proto race of proto men.
Yeah, and he gets them unhappy about their mortality. They stop following Eru and honoring the Valar. Isildur is part of this faction of the Numenorians called the Faithful, who are still like, what are you guys doing? Like, we got Eru here, and Isildur is almost kind of like a guerrilla warrior for them. At one point, he's trying to get All Pharazôn to cut down the famous white tree, which is called Nimloth, which is from the Undying Lands of Valinor. Okay. Isildur steals a fruit off of it because he's like, they're going to cut down this tree. We got to be able to get a seedling. He's almost beaten to death when that happens, but when the sapling finally sprouts, he's healed. Eventually Isildur and the faithful, they leave Numenor. Al-Pharazôn sails like an armada to Valinor. The gods get angry and they flood Valinor with a giant wave. And Isildur plants the white tree in Minas Tirith. Think when they talk about the taste of love is sweet, that he's really talking about like the pure love he had for Eru. And that's like, you know, it's a piece of fruit. That's the taste of a love's fruit.
Tyler, you knew all this, right?
Yeah. This is all common knowledge here that I'm saying. I mean, like, I'm embarrassed to be explaining it, but just in case.
Yes, Sean, we know 2 + 2 = 4.
Yeah.
Like, you know, move along here.
So,
Yeah.
Yeah. So, at the end of the War of Elves and Men, Sauron's cut down by Isildur's father, by Gil-galad, the Elf Lord, and also Isildur's father, Elendil. They both get killed. Isildur cuts the one ring off of Sauron's hand. Yeah. And he specifically talks about how hot it is. And when he puts it on his hand, it actually like burns him. Like it burns. It like literally is a ring of fire on his hand. I think that's where they talked about how he comes to you like a child. And the reason is, you know, Isildur is like 200 years old at this point, but like
that's a child.
Right after the death of your father, like you really like revert back to being a child. Mm-hmm. I feel like,
yeah. And also 200 years old is just not that old.
It's not that old for a Numenorean,
especially right after that he's dealing with Elrond, and Elrond looks at him as a child. You know?
Yeah, and then you know, when he talks about he fell into a burning ring of fire, it's a metaphor for putting it on his hand, and he ends up.
It's like saying I fell into some money.
Yeah.
Meaning I came into some money.
Yeah.
I fell into this ring. I acquired this ring.
Yeah. And then he goes down, down, down. What that's talking about is he died when he tried to escape in the river Anduin. Ring comes off his hand, shot to death by orcs.
Right. And he went down the madness, down a path of madness.
Mm-hmm. Should have destroyed the ring in Mount Doom, but, you know, he didn't. And, even though the elves were telling him to.
That's interesting. I thought when I was looking at it in terms of Lord of the Rings, I was thinking it also like the following, you know, there is like Gandalf's battle with the Balrog where he fell down. But again, like that would have to rely on the love aspect of the song relating to Gandalf's love of Middle Earth, which is it's there, but it's really more of an assignment, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah.
I mean, let's poke around a little bit with butt sex and with heroin here. I don't want to just write it off because there are some interesting things. For instance, Johnny Cash was arrested on suspicion of transporting heroin across the Mexican border in the late 50s or early 60s. He was cleared of those charges. But it is interesting that that happened and that there are Mexican horns in this, and that's where most of heroin was coming from mm-hmm. during the time. It seems to add up to something, but it's a little hard to, again, to pull that love.
Yeah. I mean, you get like, you know, he bound by wild desire, you get it, but do you feel like that's cooking up the heroin?
The what
like the burning
home, like home cooking like the love like a cooked up with love.
Oh, I just meant that he was like it burns. That's him like lighting the spoon. You I know. See.
Hmm. Yeah, I wonder if you can even tie it into, you know, I mean, obviously they sort of the song is about sort of obsession, wild desire, that kind of thing, which you know is obviously what a junkie feels for heroin, his sort of wild desire for a fix. You know, but I feel like you can even go back to Lord of the Rings there, because that makes me think of, you know, of Gollum and his sort of wild desire for the ring.
Right.
And so I don't know, maybe it's both.
Yeah. And we've talked about, I think that there's to a certain extent, a way in which lust the only thing that's truly lusted after inside of this context is like power and the ring itself. So it's like, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, and then as far as butt sex, sure. I mean, so like, who this is this Johnny Cash's first wife or second wife, right? Was saying
his
that
his first wife said he got drunk and he was on pills and he wrote this song. And then I think June is his second wife.
Yeah.
But yeah, if she's referring to it as a part of a woman's anatomy, I guess, I mean, I'm just not seeing exactly, I get, you know.
It doesn't seem like it works as well. Like the biology of it does not feel accurate.
I mean, you just don't want any of that, that, you know, burns is not something you want involved in your.
If anything, it's like Johnny Cash fell in love with a woman who gave him a venereal disease.
Sure.
Yeah.
Which I just don't feel like that's really what they're getting at.
No. Well, like a song like, you know, like Burnin' Love from Elvis or something. You know, love is often talked about as burning or hot.
Yeah.
But the ring of fire burning, it does sound a little like not quite a compliment.
Yeah, like this is a sex act when someone was like had been cooking with some jalapeno peppers and didn't realize it. You know what I mean? Like it feels like an accident happened. It's like it's, you know, it's the cinnamon flavored lube or something was involved. Like it doesn't sound delightful and passionate at all.
Yeah, I've seen some of those lubes at the store, and I'm not drawn to get them. They'll be like warming.
Yeah.
I'm like, no.
Yeah, no, it's not good. That would be my interpretation if I went with butt sex, that it would be like salad tossing, but I just don't think there's enough evidence there to back it up. Like something went wrong. And I feel like that in any interpretation, there was a misstep. There was some miscommunication. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like it might have been in Mexico. They might have been eating spicy food. They might have experimented with butt sex. They might have. It's a lot of maybes.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't, you know, I mean, the main, when I think of both, you know, June and Johnny Cash and his previous wife, I mean, Johnny Cash in general, I don't think of him as, you know, an adventurous lover, really. You know, maybe passionate, but maybe very straightforward.
Yeah, meat and potatoes.
Kind of guy. Yeah. I could be wrong. I don't want to really make too many assumptions about it. I haven't even seen the movie Walk the Line. It's not called Ring of Fire.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, Walk the Line is definitely about butt sex.
Walk the Line, the song?
Sure, right?
Maybe we should have done that one. I don't know.
I'm not sure.
Walk the line, because your mind. Okay.
I keep my eyes wide open all the time. That's like he's taking poppers. He's keeping his brown eye open all the time. Yeah.
Gotcha. Well, you know, it's. I mean, that's kind of why I wanted to like do this one early, so we could just kind of knock it out. And I think, you know,
and I would say if you're making the. Butt sex interpretation as well. That might explain if Johnny Cash really did write it and give his wife the songwriting credit, that might have been it, where it was like, if people are going to assume this song is about butt loving, like a woman singing it is still way more acceptable than a man in you know, the 1950s.
It hides it a little bit more, sure.
Yeah, it's like, it's devious, but it's not like maybe gay, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's a point I always want to like sort of reiterate that just because something is about butt sex doesn't necessarily make it about homosexuality, you know, like butts, everybody's got one and, you know, there's all kinds of things to do.
Sure.
Tackle the next one. If you have any other theories, I mean, cause we gave it our best shot here, but I feel pretty comfortable saying this about Lord of the Rings, but if you have theories, definitely call in. The phone number is in the show notes and the email is there as well. You can email us theories or call in with your own theories. Have at it. So we're going to move along here and do our second song of the evening. The Very Strange Man Who Sold the World, written by David Bowie, 1970, from his album, Man Who Sold the World. Mysterious, purposely mysterious song. He also said that he wrote it quickly, partially inspired by a poem from William Hughes Mearns. I don't know if Mearns is how you say it, called Antagonish from 1899. Was later turned into a popular song in the early 20th century called The Little Man Who Wasn't There. And here are the lyrics. We passed upon the stair. We spoke of was and when. Although I wasn't there, he said I was his friend. Which came as some surprise. I spoke into his eyes. I thought you died alone a long, long time ago. Oh no, not me. I never lost control. You're face to face with the man who sold the world. I laughed and shook his hand and made my way back home. I searched for form and land. For years and years I roamed. I gazed a gazely stare at all the millions here. We must have died alone a long, long time ago. Who knows? Not me. We never lost control. You're face to face with the man who sold the world. Who knows? Not me. We never lost control. You're face to face with the man who sold the world. It's even tough to describe what this song, what a standard or accepted interpretation of this song would be, because it is so odd. He's passing some person on the stairs. They talk. David Bowie leaves, or the speaker leaves, rather. He wanders far and wide, and he apparently thought the man had died a long time ago, but the man says, like, no, I'm still alive. Surprise, motherfucker. And that's about all the data that you can really lock down for sure on this song. Any wild theories you guys want to come in hot with?
I feel like the doppelganger portion of this is very clear, like in whatever interpretation of it. Like it does seem pretty clear that that's what he is aiming for. So I could see this as a butt sex thing, just because when he's talking about a stair, I think like one thing you have with a stair is you definitely have a top and a bottom. You know what I mean? So it's he's defining the two different levels. But I just don't know if it holds up the whole way through.
Yeah, I mean the thing that leaps out to me is face to face. Which doesn't work. You're face to face with the man who sold the world.
And I don't, I don't know what selling the world would be there too. If it was like the man who soiled the world, maybe. But I feel like there were some clues, but I don't know if it holds up all the way through.
What about you, Tyler?
I definitely think it's about heroin. That's my kind of gut instinct. I'm a big Lou Reed guy. And you know, he's obviously the kind of heroin dude. But David Bowie also huge, sort of like the original, Lou Reed Velvet Underground fan. He was back, you know, I mean, I think that David Bowie can lay claim to being the first person to cover a Velvet Underground song. He did it way back in 1966. It might have even been before the first album came out. I think that he had like an acetate or something of the first Velvet Underground record, and he learned it. And the song that he covered first, at least, was "I'm Waiting for the Man." Wow. So we've got "I'm Waiting for the Man Who Sold the World." So you know, and even that, even "I'm Waiting for the Man" has you know a reference to stairs, up three flights of stairs is where he goes up to score. He's following the man. This seems like it's a reference going back to that Lou Reed Velvet Underground tune. And it doesn't seem too far off that David would kind of have that in mind. Cause who else is the man for David Bowie? It's the man that Lou Reed went up to Lexington 125 to score and meet up with.
And he had already covered this song at that point. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, he had played "I'm Waiting for the Man" with maybe one of his first bands back in '66 or so. So he was very familiar.
Wow.
I don't know if he'd. I don't think he had met Lou Reed at this point. So I mean, you know, I don't know whether there's some kind of, I mean, a doppelganger kind of thing that you mentioned makes sense in terms of just kind of Lou and David maybe as kind of like fellow travelers, you know, heading up to this third floor place to you know, get inspiration via heroin or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, that's my thought there. I'm not sure if I can make it work for the whole thing.
I think you can take this song a lot of ways, but I ended up in the same camp where I do think that this is that Man Who Sold the World is about heroin. I think I guess in a way I sort of come at it slightly different. I think the starting point of my thinking is just that when he says, sort of starts from the get-go right off the bat, where he says, we met upon the stairs, or we passed upon the stairs. I think what is happening is he's passing a mirror and he's seeing himself after having come from the bathroom or somewhere, having just done heroin. And sort of maybe has what is sometimes what called a moment of clarity, where he looks at himself and recognizes briefly sort of like the man he used to be. And sort of like that's the person who put him in the situation he is in now, where he's addicted and he's hurting and, you know, in trouble physically and emotionally, and sort of, and it, in that moment, that man is sort of cruel to him all over again and says, I don't care that you are sick now. I am the controlling person in this sort of time warped situation where it's like, no, I am the person who did this to you, and I would do it again. Kind of odd, vaguely psychotic encounter that simply involved a mirror. It's sort of my flat reading of it.
Go ahead,
Tyler.
Oh no! I was just kidding. You know, I think that makes sense. You know, it does seem like a song that's kind of about the terror of recognition. Like seeing yourself.
I definitely agree with that read. I think there's a lot that supports it. When he talks about the stair being alone, and like reassuring himself that I never lost control. But I actually think that is not the meaning of the David Bowie version. I think that's the meaning of the Nirvana cover.
Of the famous Nirvana cover. I think
that's
cover.
Kurt Cobain confronting either his reflection or metaphorically sober Kurt Cobain. And like he's the guy who had everything, but addict Kurt Cobain is the one who sold the world. I think the David Bowie version is about a meaning of Gandalf the Grey and Gandalf the White.
Whoa. Did they meet? How would they meet?
Well, it's
in Valinor.
So what ends up happening is when Gandalf essentially dies fighting the Balrog.
Yes.
They fall into a pit in Moria. But,
for 10 days they battle.
And they climb up the famous endless stair that's in Moria. It's like infinitely high, and it ends with Durin's Tower, which is
that where
this,
they fight at the end, where he kills him?
Yeah, they end up, the flame extinguishes when they hit whatever water they're at, and then they just climb the stairs for days. Eventually, they burst out in Durin's Tower, which is at the top of the Misty Mountains, where the Dwarf Kings would go to look over their realms. That's where the Balrog bursts into flames again, and they start fighting again. So I just feel like the reference to the stairs is like the endless stair. Gandalf is reborn, and in the books, when he comes back, he almost doesn't really remember his name.
Yes.
Because he's essentially just been resurrected. And I think that's the idea of him. You know, they spoke of was and when. He's wandering around. He's seeing all this millions of years of death. And he looks in his eyes and says, I thought you died alone a long, long time ago. And kind of echoes that when people first see Gandalf, when he comes back, they say, oh, it's you, Gandalf. And he says, oh, people did used to call me that a long, long time ago. And it's like time has kind of ended for him.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Yeah.
So that was my thought. And, you know, he was the one who didn't lose control. He's the one person, the most powerful person in the book that never goes power mad and always does kind of keep under control.
Yeah. Every other person of his power level who is sent into Middle Earth fucks up somehow.
Yeah. He has access. He could have taken the ring and he doesn't, but he's still looking at essentially when he comes back as Gandalf the White, like he's at that point, he's essentially an immortal character looking at like his human, antecedent basically. Mm-hmm. So that's my thought. I don't know if we can, I don't know if that's within the rules, but I'm saying Bowie version Lord of the Rings, Nirvana version heroin.
I see. Well, I mean, I think that is definitely one of the few cover songs. I mean, Kurt Cobain liked a lot of music, but he famously loved Bowie, and this is as far as I know, the only Bowie song that he covered. Or
yeah, and I guess they played it all the time. Like it's on the Unplugged special because they. Used to the word had just been playing it for live for years before mm-hmm. that. Yeah.
And there's no question that Kurt Cobain was into heroin.
He was pretty into heroin. He also died alone but not that long ago. It feels actually a pretty long time ago. It's almost 25 years now.
It's 25. Yeah. 25 years ago this month, right?
Wow. Ouch. I was definitely had come in from rollerblading when I found out. Oof. I still had my rollerblades on when I heard.
Yeah, I can remember. I can remember when we had it was actually with Richie and our mutual friend Ryan. We had gone to a studio in Santa Monica that our other friend Sean's dad had gotten some sort of invite for us. He knew somebody who worked there. It was a recording studio that was owned by Jackson Browne.
Wow,
which is like the uncoolest place to go when you're into Nirvana and stuff like that. But I remember hearing about it right after that, and then having an argument with Ryan about whether or not Kurt Cobain would be at the stature of, you know, like Jim Morrison or something in the future. Which wow. I think we can say that I won. He's like a Morrison figure, right?
I think he has actually exceeded Jim Morrison, I would say.
Yeah, maybe so. He might be bigger than that at this point. Like, I mean, if you go into like a 13-year-old's room, are there posters of Kurt Cobain these days?
Yeah, like kids in middle school still wear Nirvana gear.
Yeah, that's pretty wild.
They do. I think probably more than the Doors right now, but that's just part of the cycle of hippies versus punk, you know, sure. Like
this. Yeah, I mean, Jim Morrison died like 50 years ago at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
High schoolers will forever be listening to Led Zeppelin, The Doors, and Nirvana, I think. And yeah, for Nirvana to have slipped into that category is remarkable.
It's good. Yeah.
There's also an interesting thing that I've kind of followed along with Bowie that goes into the schizophrenia stuff that seems to be in this song. And I do think that's fundamentally about heroin, but there's this interesting thing about, you know, like Bowie's half brother. Did you guys?
No.
So Bowie has a half brother, from the same mother who, essentially went insane, was in various asylums. And actually the original cover to this album, Man Who Sold the World, is this cartoonish cover of a cowboy with a shotgun standing outside of a drawing of the asylum where his half brother ended up. And the cowboy is sort of disintegrating, like the same way like Spider-Man disintegrates in the Avengers or something like that.
Oh,
and it's sort of like the man who wasn't there. And it, in a sense, it seems like it represents his stepfather or his brother, his half brother. And Bowie was apparently constantly afraid that he would lose his mind the same way his half brother did. but they just had enough of a difference in upbringing. I think Bowie's father was rather doting on him, where and eventually his half brother came to live with his mother and his father, but was never treated well either by his actual father, who disappeared, or by Bowie's father, who hated his half brother because he hated the man who had fathered him. And Bowie always kind of felt that neglect and abuse drove his brother to insanity, and so that he sort of had this feeling that he was close to insanity himself, and he worried about that a lot, apparently. I just thought it was interesting, and I also think it's interesting that someone in that category would then go on to do his body weight in drugs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm also taken by the mirror interpretation, because he talks about, you know, I spoke into his eyes, and I wonder if you're David Bowie and you're looking in the mirror, and maybe because you're have some vanity, maybe because it's the thing you're cutting your cocaine up on. And David Bowie famously has eyes that are two different colors. And I wonder if that kind of thing makes you a little more inclined to believe in, like, some sort duality of and doppelgangers. Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. That makes sense to me. You know, tying it back to the original cover for The Man Who Sold the World, the album, I was reading in this it's a great book. It's called Rebel Rebel. It's by Chris O'Leary. It's sort of one of those books that goes through all of Bowie's songs. This is the first volume. I think he just published the second volume. But anyway, the author was talking about that original cover, and there's a speech bubble that you can see in the cover that doesn't have anything in it.
Right.
But originally it was blocked out, and the sort of this cartoon character is saying in the original piece of artwork is, roll up your sleeves, take a look at your arms, which does seem like a a straight heroin reference.
Wow.
So, you know, I think that's a clue, some kind of clue that Bowie was trying to tell us. And then he took it away because he thought it was too obvious or something.
Mm-hmm. The only like statement I could find from Bowie was sort of like, he does sort of vaguely mention, not schizophrenia, but sort of like unity of self a little bit, mm-hmm. in the only quote I could find about it. But it does seem like, you know, he's of that, the maybe like that tail end of that real old school, rock musician where you get him in an interview and he just won't tell you shit. He's just like, I don't know. You tell me, old man, what do you think it's about? You dipshit. You know, he's like, you're not one of the cool kids and you don't get to understand my artwork kind of vibe.
Which is another thing you took from Lou Reed there.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Any interviewer who has the misfortune of talking to him is just going to get stonewalled and called a square, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah. Fascinating. What about this? Have we gone through this song and butt sex and all enough and on the other topics, or Lord of the Rings? I do like your Lord of the Rings.
I thought that was great. I might be convinced by that.
Yeah. Well, in that sense, who would be the man who sold the world, though? In that context, in the Lord of the Rings interpretation.
Yeah, the man who sold the world. It's hard. I mean, because you could see it. I could see it as like not the man who, you know, traded the world away, but the man who sold the world on an idea. But
the man who nailed the pitch meeting.
Yeah, sold in the room. Guy. Nine people going to Mordor.
That makes sense. That works. Yeah. Gandalf. Yeah, he's like a PR guy. He gave everybody kind of a vision of what could be, as opposed to, you know, what was going to happen.
Yeah. And in the more traditional metric of it, because of the results of defeating Sauron, what that means is that the Age of Elves ends and all the elves essentially abandon Middle Earth and go across the sea. So, you know, he's saving the world, but he's also basically selling the world to men from, you know, the elves, basically.
Sure. Whereas in the heroine interpretation, he's the world again is sort of like the man himself, or, mm-hmm. or you know, he sold the future, or he sold his present tense
his,
self,
his life, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, his past tense self sold his present tense self,
yeah. Mm. Like heroin just becomes your world.
Don't do drugs, kids.
Or, don't do them.
Do different drugs than that. Do better drugs.
Yeah.
It sounds like we've cracked both of these. I am happy to have Ring of Fire behind me, because every time I bring this podcast up to people, they say, oh, do Ring of Fire. And now we have.
Yeah.
So thank you for that. I think we all fully agree it's about butt sex, right? No, just kidding. Spicy jalapeno butt sex. what do you call the flaming hot Cheetos? Butt yeah. sex.
Johnny Cash, notoriously a flaming hot man. Yeah. The problem was he was always wearing black, so it was like very obvious that he would get dust all over it. And
yeah. Fascinating. Okay, so I think we've really with Man Who Sold the World really kind of walked it down with heroin, huh?
I feel good about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to thank you, Tyler, for joining us. Thank you, Mr. Sean Keane, for being here as always.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you for asking me.
Yeah.
It's a good time. I wish you guys luck in your podcasting.
Yes. We're in the
It's like a new thing, right? Podcasting. It's sort of like a something that people are doing now.
Yeah, it's like heroin, yeah.
You can listen to it on your Zune. It's really good.
Sounds good.
All right, well, good luck in the blizzardy wilds of Denver, and love to see you next time you're in Los Angeles.
Yeah, man, we'll be out this summer for sure.
Okay, cool.
Alrighty.
All right. We will have, of course, that line open for you to call in and contribute or add to these theories, or you know, come in with one of your own, and you can email us as well. Theme music by Wet and Reckless, and we'll see you on the next episode of Heroin, Butt Sex, and Lord of the Rings.